Welcome to Brain and Events. We have an unusual guest today in that our guest is anonymous. Our guest will be using the pseudonym Ivor Hardman, a pseudonym that was used in a paper published in the Journal for Controversial Ideas. And we're going to be talking about this idea of anonymous publishing and whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. Ivor, would you like to start with a thought experiment?
Indeed, I would. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Steve. I want you to imagine a close possible world in which, as a condition on defending a controversial position in print, publishers required authors to wear a baseball hat that announces that position in the form of a slogan whenever they leave the house. Authors must do this for at least 6 weeks post-publication. So in this world, for instance, Steve wouldn't be permitted to publish papers arguing against the permissibility of affirmative action unless he were willing to spend 6 weeks wearing a hat that says, ban affirmative action, or affirmative action with a thumbs down symbol next to it, whenever he goes out to the grocery store or for a walk around the neighborhood. Does it seem likely that scholarship on controversial ideas would thrive in this world?
I think the answer to that is no, but here's my question. What exactly is wrong with cancellation? So imagine people denounce a person who has a really unpopular position, perhaps a position, let's say, calling for the cancellation of affirmative action or the use of demographics to discriminate against women in hiring or in admission to programs. It's not clear that people violate anyone's rights when they denounce it denounce the proponent of this online. It's not clear that they infringe any rights. They say, look, we're not going to be friends with you. We don't want to be on a panel with you. And at a private university, it's not clear whose right they infringe when they say, look, we think this person is less likely to have a true belief, and so we don't want to hire them in our department. So in the absence of a rights infringement, I'm wondering what's wrong with broad cancellation. We can all agree that violence and intimidation would be wrong, but where is the wrongmaker here? Now, you might think, look, this doesn't have good consequences, but lots of things don't have good consequences. You might think if you don't like continental philosophy, you might think, look, to the extent that continental philosophy is permitted or subsidized, we should have a worse result, but you might think that's still something that should be permitted. So where's the wrongmaker regarding cancellation?
Good. So my claim isn't necessarily that it's wrong, morally wrong or morally objectionable. The primary claim I want to advance is that it's bad for scholarship, bad for the academic enterprise, if only people with a certain kind of character feel comfortable defending controversial ideas. So not everyone is going to have, let's say, the backbone of a Stephen Kirshner, right? Lots of people who are really smart and who might have a really important and interesting take on some topic like affirmative action or gender preferences or animal ethics, or whatever, are simply not going to want, for any number of reasons that we could discuss, to have to wear the hat. I'm to be clear with my little thought experiment, I'm envisioning this as some sort of a knockoff of a Make America Great Again hat, in the same way that only a certain subset of the population wants to wear the hat, to announce that they adhere to a certain kind of ideology across any number of different social settings. I think similarly, many people with a controversial position on some topic don't necessarily want that position to be the sort of thing that they announce in some kind of a direct way across all kinds of different social settings. And I think we're just in a situation where, unfortunately, the way that search engines and social media work, it's hard to escape just announcing that to everyone insofar as you publish it under your legal name.
So I think what's interesting about your case is that it might not have been a fair case for most of academic history. In other words, a very small number of people would read these papers. They would read in their field and they would read the entirety of the paper. So there isn't the risk that you have this slogan that has to sum up a nuanced argument. If Steve had to slogan his work on adult child sex, it's quite hard to have a nuanced slogan that you wear on your hat. But if you read the work, you can see a number of moves that are made. And I think people get more sympathetic to the work once they read it. But the difficulty that we have, as you say, is that we no longer live in that age where it's only academics who are exposed to the work and only specialists who read it and who read it in a nuanced context. What you have is this snipping that can happen. So someone can take a screenshot of a particularly salacious portion of the paper and run with that and say, this is what this person believes and this is where they live and this person should be punished for it. And when you're in that environment, as you say, it makes it very hard for people to say things that could be held to be controversial unless they have a certain character attribute. And then that narrows it down. A lot of academics went into that field because they like quiet contemplation. They might not like the public life. And so you immediately then narrow the kinds of views that will be publicly expressed. But I wonder about this. Do you think that there are any costs in allowing people to use anonymous publications or having a journal like the Journal for Controversial Ideas, which may be viewed as ghettoizing that kind of work so that it's not published in mainstream presses?
Yeah, good question. I'm inclined to say no. And the reason for this is that as far as I can tell, at least a non-negligible portion of the philosophical community has responded pretty well to the Journal of Controversial Ideas. That is, there are serious people publishing there, serious people citing the articles. A couple of people have cited my article, which suggests to me that it was read and got some uptake. And the people citing it are not weird fringe people. And they're also not people in stable positions of power. Like, I was really interested to see that somebody cited it in a dissertation. So people are engaging. And I think they're doing so in a way that they wouldn't if it didn't have the sort of, for lack of a better word, institutional support that's provided by the editorial board and people like Jeff McMahon and Peter Singer. And it's got this kind of gravitas that enables somebody to engage in anonymous publication while still reasonably expecting to have a serious inbuilt audience in a way that blogging, for instance, maybe wouldn't.
So I'm wondering about the externalities regarding anonymous publication. Your paper is really powerfully argued and quite interesting. It's well written as well. But there's a problem in the sense that to the extent you're anonymous, you avoid the vast amounts of personal attacks and career damage that might result. But on the other hand, it's hard if someone wanted to invite you to give a public speech or to debate someone who opposed this or who said that only kooks are calling for violence on behalf of animals. There's a certain problem. And also to the extent that you're a well-known and well-established academic, you lack role modeling effects. And then the next person who wants to put forth a view that sort of modifies you, perhaps even strengthens it, is going to have to bear the full weight of the hostility to your position. So while I can see that's within your rights to be anonymous, do you think that there are negative externalities? And do you think the negative externalities are overall a negative, or are they negative externalities that are weighed by certain positive benefits, particularly in getting out really powerful arguments that would otherwise not get the attention they deserve?
Yeah, I think the last thing you said is correct. I think anonymous publication is a net benefit to scholarship insofar as it provides a vehicle for advancing various points of view, for disseminating various arguments and ideas that would otherwise just remain on somebody's hard drive or confined to conversation, never written down, never published, never strengthened by the peer review process. I should add that Jeff McMahon gave me something like 8,000 words of comments on a draft of my paper. And I don't know if he believes in there being anything that's supererogatory, but I feel like that was supererogatory. Anyway, so I think there's something about allowing people to participate in this process of publication and peer review without revealing their identity that still provides this important benefit to the scholarly community. And I just acknowledge that there are some of these externalities, but I don't think that they're all that serious if we think about what the fundamental aim of scholarship is. On my view, it's to increase and improve human understanding. So yeah, there are these other things, like there are ways in which forming relationships with upcoming scholars helps them to develop their own views and thus provide scaffolding for the project of increasing and improving human understanding. But I think it's all kind of secondary stuff.
So if I could just follow up on that, do you think that that tenure, on the other hand, for those of us who have tenured, do you think that tenure is in some way a contract that says, look, we're going to give you protection, but in return for protection, you're going to put forth arguments in your name and openly promote them? And that's the trade-off you get. You get this ironclad protection that protects you even if you become completely incompetent or unproductive or ineffective. But in return, we require that you be up front and center in identifying yourself and putting forth these arguments. Or do you think like the tenure is just unconnected to this? That is, do you think there would be a greater duty for tenured faculty members to identify themselves and putting forth controversial arguments? That's not true for untenured faculty member, whether on tenure track but not yet tenured or else seeking a job.
So I think I just deny that there's a duty at all. That is, I think I deny that there's a duty here when it comes to publishing something under your own name or kind of taking a public stance as the author of a particular argument or point of view or article or whatever. Yeah, I don't think, maybe for the sake of future scholars in the history of ideas, you have some sort of pro tanto duty to somewhere leave a record of the fact that you wrote the thing, but I don't think that there's some kind of strong present tense duty to stand up and take credit for a particular argument, in part because I think some of the benefits to scholarship that pseudonymous publication can provide are benefits that don't necessarily have anything to do with avoiding cancellation. So I'll give you one example. Suppose that you've staked your reputation on defending position X, say functionalism in the philosophy of mind, and you're vain, like most humans are. And it occurs to you one day that there's this really good counterexample to one of the main arguments that you've put forward and become known for. And nobody's noticed it. You think somebody ought to bring this up. Do you want to bring it up under your own name? Do you want to undermine your own reputation and scholarly projects? Maybe not. This might be an instance where you want this objection to be out there, but you don't really want to pay the reputational cost, or you're unwilling to do so. But if you have a way of getting it out there without taking credit for it, you would do so, which would advance the project of human understanding.
So I have this concern. Does it send a signal to those that, let's say, don't have tenure, that I view this particular piece as controversial and I'm not willing to stick my neck out, and neither should you? And so it can create a spiraling norm where people become uncomfortable with publicly expressing views in their own name. And so more and more people adopt the anonymous publication stance. And it also tells you that certain ideas are ideas that people ought not to stand up for. And so, as you say, maybe there's only a certain number of people who are strong men who can stand up for these ideas. But what it might do is engender a cowardice that people just say, I don't want to stick my neck out. And if that idea isn't the kind of thing you should put your name on, I guess my idea isn't either. And you have this race to the bottom. And then that might be very bad for the discipline in general, that maybe it starts off with hiding behind a mask, but then it winds up with not expressing the idea ever, because you think, what if someone ever found out who I was? I've created a target on my back by having this anonymous thing. Someone's going to want to find out who I am. Let me just not go through the endeavor at all.
Okay, good question. I suppose that if pseudonymous publication really became something that were common, this might be something to worry about, but I wonder about how common it will become given the incentive structure of academia. So in my case, I simply don't have to worry about getting credit for this particular paper or any other paper that I might choose to publish under a pseudonym. I'm secure, I'll put it that way. And so I can do this, and it's more important to me to get the arguments and ideas out there than it is to take credit. And more importantly, given that I don't have the incentive that maybe others have, I can then think about other important kinds of considerations, like retaining control over who knows what about my views. But I think that's not typical of how academia operates, and it would probably require a pretty significant shift for this kind of thing to become not just accepted, but normative, let's say. If it did, I would worry about the spiraling effect, however, that you're talking about.
I'm curious if there's anything wrong with outing an anonymous person. Imagine that someone reads the paper and they don't violate any rights when they don't hack into the system, but they've heard the person put forth this argument in conversation in ordinary language, or they recognize the phrasing. A person has some distinctive phrasing types, or they look at the sites and they're like, I know exactly who works on those people. Or perhaps it's just a technology failure that briefly the system fails and the identification comes through and then disappears. Again, it's a little hard to see where the rights infringement is, right? It's not like the person has formed any sort of contract or made a promise to the anonymous author. And we could say, okay, it might not have good consequences, but the question is, there wasn't good consequences in this case or in all cases. You might think morality is case specific, that we should worry about its consequences in this case. Other cases are just a separate matter. I'm wondering if you think there's anything wrong with outing the anonymous authors when we see various things. Internet sleuths are quite good at outing people through a variety of means. Think about the philosophy professor who hit someone with a bike lock in one of the Antifa protests. Now, I'm not saying that publishing anonymously is like hitting someone with a bike lock. It's certainly not. But what I am saying is, what's wrong with outing someone if you can figure it out? What, if anything's wrong with it?
So I don't know that there's some unique wrong that would attach to outing someone who publishes something anonymously. But my sense is that this would be wrong because, in general, it's wrong to publicize information about people that they would prefer not to be publicized.
But look, we don't own information. I don't see why it's wrong to publish something that's true about someone. It's not Jones owns the information about himself. And if Jones is going to put forth his ideas and people care about, which they in fact do, whether they should is a separate matter, but they in fact care about the person who's actually putting forth the ideas. What exactly is wrong about releasing information that's true that the person doesn't get released? It's an odd view that we own information. I mean, there's no justice in acquisition in information. There's no justice in transfer, as far as I can tell. We don't mix our labor into the information. Information, in fact, you might think is an abstract universal. It's not the sort of thing that can be owned in any case. In what sense, assuming that a person doesn't own information regarding himself, why would it be wrong to release it when there's no ownership regarding that information?
I think the answer is because it's vicious. So I think people who would take information that's not widely known and which someone pretty clearly doesn't want to be widely known and publicize it are acting viciously. So for instance, if I come to know that you have some rare disease and it's clear to me that you've taken steps for that not to become publicly known and I publicize it, that's vicious.
So it seems like there could be cases where it's virtuous to uncover private information about someone. So you could imagine that someone has committed a series of horrible crimes in another country and you out them. It's private information. They have a strong interest in it being concealed. We would think that you did a virtuous thing by finding out that this person worked at a Nazi camp or something. There might be cases where we think what's going on is that it's a bit like a tort. So when you invade someone's privacy, they've got an interest at stake, which you're setting aside. And if there's no justification for it, especially the more private the information is, the more that it's in their sort of personal area, let's say their sexual orientation or something like that, the more we think that have performed a wrong. Steve might be more skeptical of things like torts and want to say we should ground the stuff in like contract law and there's no contract. But I think generally a lot of societies think that there's a realm of the personal that you have some interest in and that there's some reason not to release it, at least the prima facie one. What's interesting is that this doesn't just come up in academia, of course. This comes up quite often in other online platforms where it's the norm to have a pseudonymous name. So on Twitter, most people don't use their real names. They use some other kind of name. I had a close friend who tweeted under a name, and basically the tweets were all about free market capitalism. He would tweet a lot of stuff about Thomas Sowell, and then started receiving, it became publicly known that there was a campaign to out him. And other people came forward and said that they were using that handle. A number of people did it and said it's a group of us and this is a method to protect the person. But ultimately the pressure became so great that this friend of mine killed himself, that the idea of being outed was so terrifying that he ended his life. And so there is a sense in which people can have very strong interest in these things. And it does seem like there's some reason to protect people like that. I wonder about this case, which is, let's say you write a series of articles under a pseudonym. And in South Africa, there's a column that's run under the name Sergeant at the Bar. Lawyers like myself are prohibited from writing about cases that we're involved in while they're ongoing. And so it's become practice for people to use this title, Sergeant Under the Bar, to write about those cases and let the public know what's going on and have a bit of an insider take without outing who they are. And it's unknown whether one person uses it or multiple people use it. But I wonder if, let's say it is one person who's been using it, whether they've been wronged by someone else adopting the pseudonym and, let's say, writing in their style. Do you have some kind of copyright over the pseudonym? Could you say you have wronged me by using the title that I've written under? Maybe there were various famous novelists who've written under pseudonyms. If someone else comes along and uses that pseudonym to produce a novel, have they wronged the writer?
I certainly don't have any deep view on this. Although if someone wanted to adopt my pseudonym, I do not think that I would be offended. Indeed, if someone were to adopt this pseudonym to advance views that were broadly within the moral orbit of the paper that I published using the pseudonym, I think that was neat. In part because within, let's say, the radical animal rights world, this is exactly what people do when they undertake direct action as members of the ALF, right? What makes someone a member of the ALF basically is that they take up this moniker and do a thing, right? So there's some sense in which the moniker almost isn't anyone's property, right? It's associated with an ideology and a set of actions that are undertaken given adherence to the ideology. If somebody else wants to become Ivar Hardman and write other papers advancing views like mine, I say go for it.
Hey, can I just return to the, related to this with the viciousness? One, you might think there's a mismatch that viciousness has to do with features of the agent and that wrongness has to do with what you do to someone, requires a reference to the patient, the person acted upon. So you might think there's a mismatch. And so I'm wondering, but if viciousness is our test, then using Mark's question, you might think, look, there could be vicious misuses of Ivar Hardman and virtuous uses of it. So should we determine the status of outing someone or the status of using your pseudonym based on the moral character of the agent rather than what is done to someone else?
That's a good question. I have no doubt that it could be used viciously. It seems to me like that's an opportunity that's there for someone. I should hope that they wouldn't do that. But in terms of the earlier question, I think what I want to say on further reflection is that the viciousness of the person who seeks to out someone is grounded in the fact that whether they're successful or not, they're aiming to harm someone. And I just take it to be obvious that we shouldn't aim to harm people. So even if something is true, and even if it is some sense publicly available, I think that aiming to broadcast some true publicly available information in order to harm someone by making it, say, available to tens of people who are not going to think clearly about the piece of information thus broadcast, this is wrong. And if you aim to do it, you're vicious.
So you've alluded to the paper itself, which is on this question of direct action. And that paper has a series of wonderful thought experiments. Would you like to start with one and we can talk about some of the contents of it?
Sure. So suppose you're taking a walk around the neighborhood. It's late at night, very quiet. You hear something. It sounds like the cry of a wounded animal. You follow the noise. You peer into the basement of one of your neighbors from which the cry seems to be emanating. And there you see him, this neighbor, Steve, butchering a small puppy. Without hesitating, you kick down his door, run down into the basement, and accost Steve, thereby stopping him from harming the puppy. Have you done something morally permissible? My claim is both that you have, and that from the point of view of common sense morality, there's widespread agreement that you have. And that what follows from this is that it's pro tanto permissible to use coercive direct action to protect animals from serious and wrongful harm.
So I want to give you a different case. So I think there's something very evocative about the case that you've given. I think people's gut reaction is to say, of course, that's justifiable. Puppy torturing is just very wrong. But let's say we go and look at a different case, which is someone breaks into a scientist's lab. That scientist is in the process of cutting open a lab rat's head to extract its brain to perform an experiment on it, something which I think happens quite regularly. And that person destroys all the lab equipment and releases all the mice. Then people suddenly think that there's something distasteful that's gone on, that this is a bad thing to have done. And then we want to ask ourselves, what's going on here? Why the difference in intuitions? Is there just the speciesism going on that we think that puppies deserve our protection and lab rats don't? Similarly, I think if someone broke into a chicken farm and destroyed all the chicken killing equipment and saved the thousands of chickens that might be on that farm from death, people get uncomfortable because they eat chickens on a regular basis. And they say, no, you can't do that. That's someone's private property. But if Steve said, I'm entitled to torture my puppies because they're my puppies, or I intend on eating the puppy carcass or making myself a puppy scarf, we think that those aren't good reasons. So how do we tie these intuitions together?
Good question. I don't think we can, right? So I think that our kind of commitment to the wrongness of puppy torturing yields, at least if we're going to aim to be consistent, the conclusion that it is at least pro tanto morally permissible to coercively intervene on the chicken farm and in the laboratory. I now note, I say it's pro tanto permissible. I don't say it's obligatory. I don't say that there aren't potentially overriding considerations. So I'm defending, I think, a fairly weak claim, but it's nevertheless a weak claim that doesn't, that sits uneasily with, let's say, a broad set of our commitments about how to interact with animals.
So I'm curious. I think this allows for us to have a lot of targets. So imagine the following case. So you have in a Nazi death camp, you have, there's Nazis dropping the Zyklon B into showers and killing Jews. Now, before that occurs, you have people who supply the Zyklon B, and then you have people who pay for the camp, the payers. You might think, just as you could use extreme violence to kill or severely injure the person dropping the Zyklon B, you could use a lot of violence, perhaps the same amount regarding the supplier. You could also use the same amount regarding the people paying for it. Now, let's just assume for argument's sake that the value of animals is 10 to 1 regarding human beings. And let's assume that by using violence, we'll save actually 100 animals per human being. And this is not perhaps an unreasonable estimate, given that in the U.S. we kill roughly 9.8 billion animals per year, according to the Humane Society. So why wouldn't this tell us that pro tanto, we're perfectly well permitted to kill or at least severely injure people who are supplying the factory farms? Similarly, if it's the most effective way of doing so, we're free to poison the products in supermarkets. Perhaps it will kill the consumers, or perhaps we'll just make them extraordinarily sick or disabled. It would seem that we've opened up a lot of targets beside the person who is torturing the puppies or actually running the factory farms. And just let me just quickly anticipate one response. With regard to blameworthiness, blameworthiness doesn't seem to be a picture. If that doesn't seem to enter the picture, if the person about to torturing the puppies is mentally ill and therefore not blameworthy, it still seems that your pro tanto case for coercion is available. So do you think there's a pro tanto case for disabling, severely harming, or killing suppliers to factory farms and consumers who pay for it?
Good question. Approaching this from the point of view of common sense morality, which is what I want to do, rather than some overarching moral theory, what I'd want to say is that what we're committed to is using the least coercive measures available in order to prevent harm. So go back to the initial case. I don't know that the initial case would justify you in killing the puppet torturer. I think it justifies you in using coercion, but let's assume you can out-wrestle him. If you can out-wrestle him, then it's not at all clear that you're permitted to shoot him. And again, as blameworthiness doesn't enter in, or retribution doesn't enter in, so it's not at all clear to me that common sense morality would license beating him to a pulp to show him that he's wrong after you've used sufficient coercion to prevent him from continuing to torture the puppy. So then what I want to say about some of these other kinds of cases is, I think, analogous. Is killing consumers the least coercive way of preventing some of these kinds of harms? Moreover, it seems to me that this is such an indirect method of harm prevention that, at least absent commitment to something like a consequentialist moral theory, you're not going to be able to get to that conclusion.
So I have two responses. One is, I'm just going to presuppose that killing is the most effective way or the only way to stop in the puppy case. But I'm not interested in the puppy case. What I am interested is in the Zyklon B case, which I think is far more parallel to what we're dealing with. And in the Zyklon B case, and this is on deontological grounds, in addition to consequential grounds, it seems to me that you can target suppliers and consumers. And just as an empirical matter, I flat out disagree with you about what's effective. If we learn that pork products, that there's poison in the Detroit area regarding pork products, I strongly suspect that the sale of pork products will drop like a stone. So let's presuppose that killing is the only way to stop it or the most effective. Let's use the Zyklon B analogy rather than your puppy analogy. Again, I think it's a better analogy because it more closely tracks what's going on in factory farms. And my question is, does that tell you that suppliers and consumers can be targeted and in fact can be targeted with lethal force? And if it's only, by using the puppy case, you might think, okay, one puppy, perhaps because of status, one puppy is less valuable than a human being, whatever number is necessary. And in the Zyklon B case, clearly, since it's human versus human, and we're pumping up the numbers that are going to be killed, there we don't have a status issue. So my question is, based on the Zyklon B analogy and holding my claim constant, assuming my claim that killing is the only way and also the most effective way, do you think that we can use violence and including lethal violence against supplier and consumers of factory farms?
So here I'm going to take you to the end of the paper. And what I'm going to want to say is something like, yes, but. So it seems to me that my arguments might take me to an affirmative conclusion in your cases. And if we're talking about Zyklon B and the Holocaust, we're in, let's say, a historically unique situation, unlikely to be replicated. Now compare that to the present day situation concerning intensive confinement animal agriculture. So I don't think we're going to stop that by poisoning pork products. Why not? What we've seen when, for instance, mad cow disease came on the scene is that people reduced their beef intake for a while, and then most of them just started to go back to their old ways, right? So this did have some appreciable effect on beef consumption and probably had some appreciable effect on the overall number of animals that ended up in intensive confinement facilities. But I think it didn't last for very long. So if the aim is to prevent some sort of historically unique catastrophe that's not an, I don't know, an ongoing project like intensive animal agriculture is, intensive confinement animal agriculture, there I think there's a disanalogy. But I just want to add this bit because I did say something about the end of the paper. So I think that, look, I think if we went out and started poisoning animal foodstuffs, this would have a pretty dramatic effect on people's consumption habits. But I think it would also have a pretty dramatic effect on how people think about the, say, broader animal rights movement, and that this would be uniformly negative. And in the long run, I'm not at all clear that this would promote something like sympathy for the cause that the actors in this case are aiming to promote. So what if we're thinking about the long run interests of animals as an aggregate? It's not at all clear to me that killing pork consumers is going to do much to promote those interests. And it seems to me likely that killing pork producers might actually do a lot of things that would have a net negative effect.
So I suppose if we're trying to work out how bad it is to factory farm animals and kill them and eat them, it's useful to come up with these analogous cases where we think we could have some kind of strong direct action. And Steve's right that, you know, people would say, well, the Allies were perfectly entitled to go and bomb concentration camps and kill the guys that worked there, and maybe bomb the factories that was producing Cyclone B, and that it was okay to kill those people to save lots of lives. Then the question is, if it is effective, if let's say you act in that manner where you go and bomb a whole bunch of animal farms to stop the killing equipment, if you get uncomfortable with that, it seems like maybe people for a while go, these animal rights guys are a bunch of terrorists and they're bad people and they don't like what the movement is doing. But if you think that all those animals' lives really matter, let's say people who didn't like the Allies coming in and destroying the concentration camps or didn't like people going around freeing slaves and thought badly of the abolitionist movement, you might just say, so what? We're doing the right thing. We're on a righteous crusade, and what people think about our movement is rather neither here nor there. What matters is saving the lives. And so I wonder if your side constraint of what people think about the movement is too strong a constraint if the harm that's going on is as catastrophic as you claim.
So I think it's a side constraint that basically just has to be properly balanced. And I don't claim that I know precisely how to strike that balance. But it seems to me that what happens if we undertake some of the most extreme kinds of direct action, especially highly publicized things, is not that we rescue any animals or that we win any converts. So I want to point out here too that, right, so if I go and poison pork products and therefore pork consumption drops by 5%, does it follow then that the pork supply in the country is thereby decreased by 5%? I don't think it's not, the causation is not that direct. It's just as likely that some thousands of pigs, instead of being turned into bacon, just get killed and have their bodies thrown in a ditch somewhere. There's an example that I talked about in the paper, actually, according to which during the pandemic, one of the major pork suppliers in Iowa was left with an oversupply of pigs. And so they just turned on the heat in one of the factories where they were confined and basically scalded them all to death. Absent the idea that there's some kind of clear rescue, I'm not sure how to work out the kinds of consequentialist considerations that would justify these sort of more indirect actions against consumers and producers and people like that. But I do think there's empirical evidence suggesting that some of this stuff makes people far less sympathetic to the sort of broader aims of the animal rights movement.
So just a quick follow-up so I can see how you're doing the calculation, even for your deontological level of violence. So let's assume in your case, you're deciding whether or not I can kill the puppy torturer. Now, you might think, okay, look, so my first question is, is each puppy as valuable as a human being? And if not, what determines the ratio? I'm not saying you have to give me a specific ratio. What makes it 10 puppies are equal to one human being or 100 puppies? That is, what's the status maker? And second, what tells us once we have the status? So let's say 100 puppies is as valuable as one human being. What determines how much violence we can use? So we want to know, are we limited to breaking his thumb, or can we take off one of his limbs, or can we slaughter him? Assuming that the most violent thing is the most effective, so killing him is more effective than taking off a limb, and taking off a limb is more effective than breaking his thumb. So one, what determines the ratio, and two, what determines the amount of violence that we may use?
Good questions. I don't have very good answers to these questions, however, because I think ethics is hard. But in some sense, what I want to say, and this rests uneasily with some of my other views, what I want to say is human life approximates being invaluable. So I actually really don't like these kinds of comparisons between the value of human lives and the value of animal lives, despite the fact that I have this kind of radical animal rights view. So I really want to avoid killing people if possible. But I do think there are cases where killing people for the sake of preventing catastrophic harm to animals would be permissible. I just don't know where the threshold is.
But my concern is if we don't have a value ratio, and we don't have an equation for proportionality in defense of violence, then how do we know that we're above the threshold? And I know you're going to say my intuition is such that, but what explains the intuition? Is it really obvious that if a person is torturing a clam or a crab that we can do it? And you might think, no, not clams or crabs, but yes, on puppies or pigs or elephants. And I want to know what's explaining this. And you can say, well, this is just my intuition, and it's an intuition that you share, which I do. But I suspect that if I cannot even tell you what determines the relative status, or I can't even gesture toward how we get a plausible proportionality equation, which of course is going to have to take the status value of the individuals involved in effect, then I'm worried we just don't know whether we're under or over the threshold, or the amount of violence might be so low that's just ineffective. The most we can do is give the puppy torturer a really hard pinch. You might think that's not going to deter very many puppy torturers. So in refusing to give us like a status maker or a ratio or an equation of proportionality, are you significantly undermining the confidence we have in your central thought experiment?
I think that my answer is going to be a tu quoque reply. So I think we lack these kinds of things in the human case as well. So think about a case of justifiable defensive action. There is an intoxicated person who is walking out to his car. It's clear to me that he's going to drive the car. It's clear to me that he's very intoxicated. How much violence, how much coercion can I use to stop him from getting behind the wheel? I don't think I can kill him. Pinching's not going to be enough. It seems to me that if he does drive the car, this is very bad. And I think most of us would agree that some amount of coercion to prevent him from driving the car would be justified. Do I need to have a clearly articulable threshold for coercion to know that it's permissible for me to pin him to the ground? Because I think it is permissible for me to pin him to the ground. And I suspect that both you and Mark would agree.
No, given the lack of probability that a drunk driver is going to injure someone, and it is extraordinarily unlikely, even though it is significantly enhanced from like an unimpaired driver, it's not clear to me that you could pin him to the ground.
Really?
And I'm worried that the sort of violence that we need to use in the puppy case, let alone the Zyklon B case, is rather severe violence. So to have the kind of implications that you're talking about, I think we at least have to have doesn't have to be any precise equation, but just a general rough sense of what are the major factors, what's a general status trade-off. Otherwise, I just worry that we're taking too much from the central thought experiment.
We may use pretty serious coercive measures to defend the interests of animals, but that those generally stop short of killing and taking people's arms off, though there are probably exceptions to this general rule, right? So I just don't see how, in cases of rescue, for instance, and these are really the kinds of cases that I want to focus on, it's rare that you would need to kill someone or cut their arm off, right? So you can threaten them with a gun. So threatening violence, threatening even extreme violence, I think is permissible. So you can threaten to shoot them. You can beat them up pretty badly. But given that you don't need to kill them in most cases, that's just going to be off limits. Now, what about cases where you might need to kill them? There, I'd want the rescue to be very substantial. And I don't know how to fill out very substantial. But it would need to be something, thousands and thousands of animals, I'd say.
So let's think about it in practical terms. The rescue case sounds quite nice. You can imagine there's a group of activists who go to the fox fur factory and they let the beautiful foxes out and the foxes run wild. And we say, yeah, that seems pretty good. But what happens if you do that at the chicken slaughter plant? You open up all the layer hen cages or you let the broiler chickens go. What happens to them? It's not clear that they're the kinds of critters that can survive in the wild. In a way, they are bred to be eaten. So they're mutated in some senses. They can't really support their own weight. They're going to have a pretty horrible time once they get out into the wild. They might die worse deaths than if they were killed in the factories. So it seems if you really care about those chickens, the best way to solve the problem is to ensure that they aren't brought into existence at all. So you remove any desire for people to eat them, or you destroy the kind of market mechanisms people don't produce them. And that seems like it's going to save, Steve gives a figure of nearly 10 billion animals a year. That seems like an enormous amount of animals that you could save through stopping them from being brought into existence and then killed. One method that would be finally resolve the problem would be if humans no longer existed. So you might think it's a step too far to go out and kill all the human beings that are there. But what if you were able to put something into the water supply that made everyone sterile so that this current generation will live out until they die, but there'll be no further human beings and those future human beings won't be able to go and treat all the animals very badly. And with humanity becoming extinct, then, you know, animals will live on the planet in some sense of harmony. Would you endorse such a view to save them?
No. Again, maybe surprising given sort of some of the other views that I defend, but so I am in some sense a human exceptionalist, despite my radical animal rights views. And indeed, in the paper, I claim that these views are grounded in common sense morality. So I don't think that one needs to be a kind of misanthrope to end up with the sort of position that I've got. So I think that humans are uniquely valuable. I think that a human life is invaluable. I think that a human life is invaluable in part because it's irreplaceable. That is, each human life manifests a kind of uniqueness enabled perhaps by our capacity for self-reflexive and higher order thought that can't be assigned some kind of quantitative value. So I hold all of these sorts of views that are ordinarily perhaps used to justify subordinating animals. But I just don't think that they do. I think you can be a kind of a human exceptionalist. You can think that human lives are invaluable and nevertheless think that what we're doing to animals is abhorrent, and that in fact, we're undermining our own humanity in doing it.
So if I could just follow up on Mark's question, imagine they thought that, look, harm becomes more permissible if the person either forfeits his right against the harm or if he deserves it. So you might think culpable wrongdoers, we use defensive violence against them. It's either permissible or at least less wrong in virtue of the fact the person's forfeited the rights or deserve it. And one way you could see that is, look, if you had a fully functioning adult human being who was severely torturing a cognitively disabled human being, it would seem that this is wrong and we could use severe violence, perhaps even kill the torturer, even though he has rationality, autonomy, all the sort of factors you cite. Given the sheer numbers, 10 billion animals a year in the U.S. alone, let alone what's going on in other countries, and given the either forfeiture or severe desert of many of the human beings, it would seem that the sheer numbers, when linked to the discounted value to the harm of culpable wrongdoers, or perhaps just flat out wrongdoers, would permit us to sterilize human beings, or perhaps if you're the you're Martians, you could just flat out kill them. And in terms of the infinite value, I'm not sure why that makes sense. We make trade-offs all the time. We say, look, we'd rather save three children than one. Of course, that calculation is not going to work if people have infinite values. Or we say we'd rather sacrifice a few lives for greater economic efficiency by raising the speed limit. So it's pretty clear that human beings don't have infinite value. So assuming they have finite value and assume that we can discount their harm by the forfeiture of the desert, why not say the following? Look, if the Martians could take out the human race, they should do so based on the fact that the 10 billion plus factory farmed animals every year that are being tortured and who are made miserable in their brief existences. So what would be the case against Martians just wiping out humanity, which is just a more violent version of Mark's question, why not sterilize the human race?
Good. So I think we're just going to have a kind of baseline disagreement maybe about the value of human lives. And I think that you can hold the view that an ordinary human life is invaluable and still consistently hold the view that we sometimes permissively make trade-offs. So, yeah, I should save three people over one, all things considered. Three invaluable lives over one. So I guess I don't see what the problem is with that. But should the Martians destroy us?
Sure, the problem is just right quickly, three times infinity is not greater than one times infinity. But yeah, my main question is, why should the Martians destroy us even if we, so long as there are trade-offs, that's fine. Why should the Martians destroy us on behalf of their protecting animal victims?
Yeah, I don't think the Martians should destroy us because despite our sort of foibles, humanity has a kind of value that can't be reduced to even the worst kinds of things that we do. And I guess for me to think about this in terms of just harm reduction, I think fails to capture the positive value of creatures like us existing. So yeah, we could prevent lots and lots of harm by destroying the human race. We could also prevent lots and lots of harm by just all choosing to be abstinent, or all choosing to maybe not be abstinent, but all choosing not to procreate. But I think most people lead reasonably good lives. So I think from a kind of self-interested point of view, there's a lot of value that enters the universe that way. But I also think there's this kind of higher order good that instantiates itself in an individual human life that simply isn't reducible to the specific individual bits of prudential or self-interest value that might aggregate across the course of a human life. That's the kind of view that I have.